For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, maybe you've asked yourself the question before. As you followed Christ, you come to a point where you feel like, why is it that as I continue to follow Christ, it feels like I just have to give up more and more and more and more? Oh, here's another thing, and here's another. Maybe you've asked yourself the question, why do I see a heightened irritability and frustration in my relationships? These are people that are around me, and yet all of a sudden I just feel irritable. Like it just isn't the same as it used to be. How is it that I could spend so much time around people but still feel lonely? How is that possible? I don't know if you felt this way or asked these questions. I've been in each one of these where there's certain points where you feel like I just don't feel like I could give anything more. Or just feeling like it's these people you've put around me. So irritable, so immature, so sinful, unlike me. And then other times of loneliness, where you're spending time with fellow, you know, Christians frequently, and you feel lonely. Why is that? Well, we're going to look at that tonight, see if we can answer some of these questions from the Word. We read in Romans 13:8, Paul says, "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law." We read, for example, "You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet." Those are the Ten Commandments, aren't they? 6, 7, 8, 10. And if there's any other commandment, so he named 4 out of the Ten Commandments, and if there's any other, it is summed up in this saying. So what do you think he's going to hit here? You know, the whole Ten Commandments and any other commandment in the Old Testament law, what does it all mean? What is it summed up as? What's the Christian life about? What is true spirituality? That you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Paul says in 1 Timothy 1:5, he says, the goal of our instruction. What's the goal? All this teaching, all this study, all this time together, what's the point? It's love. Paul says, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. If you remember back in Romans chapter 8, verse 4, Paul said that the requirement of the law would be fulfilled in us. You start to dwell on the love of God for you, and you just want to give this away. So we want to think about the subject of biblical love. Let's ask 3 questions here tonight. First of all, what is love? Number 2, why is it that we should love other people? And then number 3, how is it that we should love people? So what is it, why should we do it, and how do we do it? Let's start with that first question. What is love? Well, the word love in English, unlike in Greek, see in Greek they had all these different words for love. Agape, which was a sacrificial love. Phileo, which was like a brotherly love. Storge, eros, which is our root that we get erotic from. For us, we just have one word. It's love. That's all we have. And it has a huge semantic range. So, for example, you could hear somebody say, she fell in love. How are we supposed to interpret that? It's almost like it's something that's happening to you. I couldn't help it. Like I fell into a ditch. You know, I couldn't help it. She fell in love. Or they were making love. Oh, wow. This sounds more active than the other one, for sure. More on that next week. You'll have to come back to hear some more about that. Or somebody says, I love this song. You know, you're sitting out at a bar and Journey comes on. And, you know, don't stop believing. I love this song, you know. Boy, that's different. The statement, he loves his wife. Well, that's way different than he loves this song. He loves his grandma. Way different than he loves his wife. Way different. I love Taco Bell. Which, incidentally, is the first time that's ever been said in the English language. What we mean when we hear that is, it was late, I was desperate, I had nowhere else to turn. And now I'm filled with deep self-hatred and shame. That's how you would define it. I love Taco Bell. There's also worldview considerations here as well, if you think of different worldviews. different worldviews are going to look at this phenomenon of love in different ways. You know, if we were to be reductionistic under naturalism, the worldview that there's just nature, just, you know, chemicals, energy, physics, that's it. There's no soul, there's no immaterial aspect to yourself or to others. Love would just be reduced to chemicals and hormones. So Leah Lowndes, for example, she's a best-selling author on relationships, of all things. Writing February 14, 2015, she says, for accuracy, you should send your main squeeze a Valentine's Day card with the image of a squishy gray blob evocative of a rotting cauliflower, the brain, because that's where romance really resides. And instead of saying, I love you, the knowledgeable lover would say, darling, dopamine floods my caudate nucleus every time I look at you. That's hot right there. That is a new pickup line right there. Hard to define, and you got different worldviews to look at it differently. Linguistically, it's difficult to define. Well, we're here at a Bible study, so we would do ourselves a favor not to import our views of love onto the text, but actually to export what is it the Bible teaches about the subject of love. A pretty good working definition I found useful was this. Love is the commitment to give of myself in every area, and here's the important part, for the good of another person. So it's a commitment. This is something I'm committing to of myself in every area. So 4 out of the 5 wouldn't be enough. I'm trying to commit fully, not for myself, but for others. And we could break these up into maybe 4 crucial categories here. Let's think of sacrificial. Jesus says in Matthew 5:46, he says, if you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. The tax collectors in the first century were the traitors of the nation of Israel, taking taxes, bilking their fellow citizens to give to the evil empire of Rome. And Jesus says, yeah, even one of those people, they know how to love people to love them. There's nothing biblically loving about that. Anybody can do that. And so when we think about biblical love, this is sacrificial. This is moving toward people that I wouldn't naturally have an affinity toward. Jesus said in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, he said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is at the core of Christian love. Is I'm not showing up expecting to be served. People who make statements like this, well, no one initiates with me. No one talks to me. Nobody texts me. Nobody invites me. That's really more an indictment on you than it is on other people. For a Christian, a mature Christian, I'm talking, this is something that's going to take years to develop. This is not something that you meet Christ and all of a sudden there's pixie dust and all of a sudden you're a mature sacrificial lover. It takes time. We're all in process here. But for a mature Christian to initiate love, it's not viewed as a burden. It's viewed as an opportunity. That there's one thing I can control. Love. I know every time I show up to a meeting with other believers that I can't control, cannot control how people are going to love me. I can't control them like that. I can control how I love them. Jesus said, John 15:13, he says, greater love is no one than this, that one laid down his life for his friends. Talk about sacrifice. And this is on the final night of Jesus' life. The apostles, they stay up all night, and first thing in the morning, Jesus literally does this for them. He, in John 18, he says, take me, leave them. Lays down his life for his friends. And then Romans 5:6, which you see this repeated refrain, Romans 5:6, Romans 5:8, Romans 5:10, that while we were still helpless, while we were still sinful, while we were still enemies of God, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. If God was waiting for us to initiate with him, we would have never come into a relationship with him. Would have never happened. Paul has earlier said, no one seeks after God. The reason that anyone is a follower of Jesus is because he sought after them. He wasn't the one who was lost, okay? We were. and he came and found each one of us and drew us to himself, there's a component where we have to receive the gift of Christ. But if it wasn't for his work, we would have never been interested in the first place. So this sacrificial aspect to the love of God, crucial to who God is. Number two, it's forgiving. Forgiveness. What does this mean? This Greek word, aphesis, is the typical word used for forgiveness in the New Testament. It means to release, to let go, to give up, to release from legal or moral obligation or consequence, to cancel, to remit, to pardon. You think tonight, later tonight, perhaps somebody comes over to your house and they're driving kind of recklessly and they sideswipe your car. And you're like, man, that car is worth at least $1,200, you know, and you just sideswipe the whole side of it. Well, what are you going to do? You could say, well, I forgive you, right? So basically what you're saying is you don't have to pay the price for that car. On the other hand, by saying that you forgive them, you're letting them off the hook. That means that you have to pay the price for that car. I got to pay for the damages. Or maybe you say, well, I have insurance on this lemon car I own, and the insurance company is going to pay for the car. The point is, somebody needs to pay for the car. And I'm sure you can see where this is going. When God forgives us, he doesn't just say, well, I forgive you. You know, looking at all the horrible evil in the world, what would it be like if God just said, well, I forgive you? What does that even mean? How much did it cost him to forgive all this evil and sin in the world? Nothing. Under the biblical view, what did it cost God to forgive us? Everything. It cost him his son. And so somebody had to make the payment, and instead of making us make that payment, God said, I'm going to release you. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to give that up. And instead, I'm going to put that payment onto my son. And so the price has been paid. And likewise, as people who are the most forgiven people in the world, Christians, we should be the most forgiving people in the world. Because we have been forgiven from so much, more than we could ever imagine. You know, what is it that I deserve? I deserve to wake up apart from God in hell, to pay judicially for every moral wrongdoing I've ever done. Instead, God says, I forgive you. Why? Because you asked for it. That's why. When we forgive other people, it's on the basis of the forgiveness of Christ. This isn't necessarily a feeling. In fact, sometimes you feel exactly the opposite. I've been hurt. I've had my trust betrayed over and over, sometimes by the same people. And you go to forgive them and to release them of the debt, you know, the retaliation, the revenge, hurting them in my heart. And very often you don't really feel anything. It takes time. Sometimes there is a feeling. Not till later. It also doesn't occur overnight. You know, some people have said, well, I have forgiven her, and yet I woke up today and the same feelings of animosity and hatred just filled my heart. Well, you know, Jesus said that you have to forgive your brother how many sins? 70 times 7 or 77. We're not sure. However many, it's a ton of sins is what he said. One author put it, we got to forgive our brother for 77 sins. We also have to forgive our brother 77 times for the same sin. And so just like every other aspect of the Christian life, you know, think about sexual lust. It isn't like one day I just, you know, I'm feeling lust towards somebody and then I'm like, oh, Lord, no, I don't want to take from another person. And I pray about that and then I never lust for the rest of my life. Oh, yeah. That's never happened. So the same thing is true here. We got to get used to this. So I forgive a person, and I wake up the next day, and then that hatred, that anger, animus is still there. What do? I forgive them again. That's what. And there will come times where you discover those who don't forgive, this, for some people, it blurts out in these outward, you know, fireworks and catastrophic anger outbursts. For other people, most people, it turns inward, where it turns into the Cold War. I just despise people. I won't talk to them. Nagging, that's usually a sign that we haven't forgiven somebody. Irritability, that you're just irritable with people, that you just, everything is on edge. And really at the core of it, why is that? Why am I so at odds with other people? It's because I'm harboring a lack of forgiveness in my heart. I need to let this go. And all of a sudden you discover as you start to do this, you learn forgiveness. All of a sudden the Lord, it's like the walls were shut, the doors were closed. The line was dead in prayer, and then all of a sudden you forgive, and the Lord is just like speaking to you like crazy. And you feel like the spiritual lights come back on at this point. A third aspect would be emotional, an emotional aspect of love. Did you know? It's a command to feel for other people. Don't believe me? Romans 12:15, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. So you might be the kind of person who's, you know, kind of a stoic, an ice queen, a person that's a mannequin, you know, you don't really show very much emotion. And yet you look at other people who are weeping, you are commanded to weep. Somebody who's rejoicing, no, to sit there with just a blank expression on your face. This isn't meeting people's emotional needs. There's something about being in Christian community where we have love, real love. And part of this is emotion, that people's emotional needs are met. We get this first and foremost from God. We also get this from each other. We read in Ephesians 4:32, be kind to one another, tender-hearted. Tender-hearted. What was it about Jesus that we see in multiple episodes in the Gospels that children would just flock to him? When I think about Jesus, there was a tough man. To be sure, he would call out groups of authorities. He, you know, took the most incredible pain, danger to himself, sacrificial, brave. No one was more courageous than Jesus. And, you know, he would walk into a room and people would kind of feel the sense, here is a strong man. Here is the alpha that just walked in, and he would strike fear into the hearts of religious leaders. And yet little kids would see Jesus and they wanted to climb on him like a jungle gym. So why is that? What was that about him? It was this tender-heartedness. Instead of the sarcasm, instead of the negativity, the being the contrarian all the time, it's this a real sweetness, a wholesomeness, emotional. You might have to pray for it. I know I do. I go into situations where I just say, God, I can't feel. I don't know what I'm feeling. And you have to pray, God, give me the feelings. Not just to have the feelings, but to show them, to express them. And then number four, it's confrontational. There is a component to love. Just think, if we were missing any one of these, it would be like, you know, having four wheels on a car and you take away one of the wheels. It's not 75% as fast. It's 0% fast. It's not going to go anywhere. And this would be a crucial component to be confrontational at times. Again, for the good of the other person. Biblical love is not this amorphous, mushy, everything's cool, cool, cool. Oh, yeah. I'm watching this person who's ruining their life, and I'm permissive. I'm passive. Really, what you're saying is I'm self-protective. I don't care enough to do anything. And biblical love is not this way. We read in Matthew 18:15, Jesus said, if your brother sins, and this must be some kind of a serious issue, moral failing, he says, go and show him his fault in private. So this would be the pattern that Jesus sets up. We pull a brother or sister aside, it's privately, and say, dude, did you see how that affected her? Or I've been noticing there's a pattern here. And he says, if he listens to you, you've won your brother. See, that's the goal. The goal isn't that I'm just trying to verbally accost another person. The goal is that I'm trying to win this person over. So whatever tension is needed, I'm going to bring that. Because I'm trying to have the right amount of tension to show this person this is a big deal. But, Jesus says, if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you. I've had this happen. I could count on one hand where I was just so thick-headed, I couldn't see it, that one person coming to talk to me, I was just like, you're seeing things. And then to have one or two more say the same thing, all of a sudden it was like, whoa. Okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to write off each one of these guys who love me, and I'm going to say, oh, you're all crazy? No, maybe I'm the one who's crazy here. Maybe I have the issue. Paul says, 2 Corinthians 7:8, though I caused you sorrow by our letter. That should stop us right there. There are many people that are so terrified at hurting someone's feelings. Now, I'm not the kind of person that enjoys this. I don't like to hurt people's feelings. But Paul is saying here, he wrote a letter and it hurt their feelings. Yet, he says, I do not regret it. I said what I meant. I meant what I said. Though, he says, I did regret it. You know what I mean? It's like a sorry, not sorry. Sometimes when you go into one of these confrontations where you're trying to speak the truth in love, you say something and you see the person is hurt and you hurt. And at the same time, you're thinking to yourself, but I believe this is true. You needed to hear that. And so Paul says, for I see that the letter caused you sorrow, though only for a while. I now rejoice, not that you were made sorrowful. That's not the point, is to go around hurting people's feelings. Not that, he says, but that you were made sorrowful to the point of repentance. That you had a change of mind. That's all that means. I know that's biblical language. People with street signs, repent, you know, or else. The Bible, it's a beautiful term. It just means to have a change of mind where I was moving in one direction and all of a sudden I'm moving in a different direction. And the liberating, uplifting feeling you have. And Paul says, I was very happy about that. And this needs to be in our quiver. It needs to be an arrow that we're willing to fire from time to time, a confrontative word. This isn't based on justice. This isn't based on fairness. It isn't that we have a rule book and we say, well, he had an anger outburst. So, all right, rule number 76, if they raise their voice to 15 decibels, okay, now I'm going to have to say this to them. There's nothing like that. It's whatever is a good word for the sake of the other person and for the sake of other people around. Somebody who blows up, I'm also not just thinking about them. I'm thinking about the person they blew up on. And so it's not justice. I'm thinking, what would be the right thing to say that would resolve this and that the person would see it? It also isn't uncontrolled. We want to be in control. In fact, when I go into these situations where I feel like God is telling me you need to speak a word here of confrontation, I pray. I say, God, please give me the right amount of heat. Not too much, not too little. I pray I wouldn't go over the top. I pray I wouldn't name call, browbeat, humiliate, say anything like that. That is totally out of bounds. Nothing like that. But to be able to even have some emotion and some chutzpah that's put into this, because sometimes you get the sense that you're talking and the person's like, oh, yeah, it's a big deal. And then you feel like, I'm not getting through. And you have to come in again and have the right level of tension. Well, that's the definition of love. That is a tall order. That is nothing like our culture would define it. I mean, go ahead and look this up. Wikipedia, Merriam Dictionary, whatever.com. I don't know. I don't care. You look up the definitions. Nothing like this. This is a whole new level of love. Why would we ever do that? This sounds insane. Why would I ever want to get involved in something like this? Well, for one, God loved us this way only to an incredible degree, and he did it first. And he did it, believe it or not, without conditions. He went out there in a risky form of love to love us, to die for every man, woman, boy, and girl on planet Earth, to die for them, that they would come to him, that they would come to know him. So we read in 1 John 4:7, John says, dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. So it's possible that you could be born of God. That's this proposition of receiving the gift of Christ. And yet you might not know God. That deeper level, that maturity, where we're getting deeper into the love of God, as we're going to see here in context, we might have a deficient form of love. Why? Because we're just not loving people? Yes. But also because we haven't known God deeper and deeper. So John says, whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. Notice what he doesn't say. He doesn't say that you weren't born of God. He says you don't know God. You're not close with him. You're not deep with him. He says in verse 10, this is love. Not that we loved God. It wasn't like that at all. Let's not have revisionist history here, right? I just really love God so much that he just couldn't help it but be with me. Not that we loved him, but that he loved us and to the extent that he sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, he says, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. That would be a pretty good case right there. If that's all we had, that God would love us to such an extreme extent, and I'm going to stand here with a justification, an attitude of saying, I'm not going to lift a finger for anybody. How do you justify that? How do you sit there and just say, well, I'm expecting people to love me. I'm not going to give out to anyone. When God himself, what else would it take to get you to love? Couldn't think of an answer. And so he says in verse 16, he says, we know and rely on the love of God that he has for us. So now we're going to, from being born of God to knowing God, and now we're actually trying to trust in this. This right here is the hardest thing to do in the Christian life. To believe that God is really that loving. Very difficult. To change your behavior, easy. You know, to stop doing this thing and start that thing, easy. I can do that. But to sit there and really believe that God is that good, and to know it, and then to rely on it, that means to trust in it, the unfathomable love of God. So he says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. So this isn't fear threat. It's not you do it or else. He says, we love because he first loved us. Well, if that's all we had, that'd be enough right there. But there's more. Number two, God supplies the power for us to love other people. So we read in 1 Peter 4:11, whoever speaks is to do so as one who is speaking the utterances of God. That feeling that when you open up to speak to somebody, do you get the sense that God is speaking through you to that other person? He says, whoever serves is to do so as one who is serving by the strength which God supplies. This isn't self-effort. It's as I go out there to serve, I'm trusting, I'm relying upon that God is going to show up. And so this would do away with that idea, well, if I'm out there loving other people, then who's going to love me? God, that's who. He's going to meet all your needs. Don't worry about that. Our problem isn't that we love people too much. Our problem is that we love ourselves too much. We're real good at that. 24 hours a day, you know, 168 hours a week. We're real good at loving ourselves. It's as we go out to love others. That's the real issue. Third, it speaks powerfully to others. I remember as an atheist coming around one of these small Bible studies we have here on campus. And I remember getting in the car. My buddy was like, hey, you should come to this Bible study. I was like, that sounds like a good idea, until I got in the car. And we're making small talk and chatting. And I had that background, you know, like on a computer, that background information running. And I'm just like, why am I the bad idea? Jump out of the car. How fast is it going? You know, I'm like, if I go there, they're going to make me sing. They're going to make me share. They're going to know I'm not a Christian. They're going to know that. And so I showed up to that meeting and I just was completely blown away. I could not believe it. There were the nerds and there were the jocks. And I didn't fit into either category. I transcended categories on that. You're like, that's what a nerd would say. But I remember looking at these two guys and I couldn't tell you what the teaching was about. I couldn't tell you most about the night, but I could tell you verbatim what some of those conversations were. I remember looking at this big, beefy, you know, meathead guy, and he came over to one of the nerds and just gave him a big bear hug and just looked at him. How are you doing, man? Good to see you. And I was just like, what is this? I just couldn't explain it. Well, Jesus can explain it. He says, John 13:34, he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also would love one another. Now catch this. By this, your love for each other, by this, all men will know that you are my disciples. If, there's the condition, if you have love for each other. A lot of times, at least for me, I wasn't necessarily thinking, can I believe what these people believe? I was thinking, could I be like one of these people? So many weird Christian people I came into contact with. It was just like, I can't even get there. Once I could see, okay, this is real, this is love, all of a sudden, the message about Christ became very palatable, that's for sure. And number four, it is the secret. Why should we love? It is the secret to a happy and fulfilling life. It's a secret that's out in the open, Okay, this isn't some kind of new age thing where it's a secret only a few of us know. God's like, it's the secret that is really out there in the open, just nobody listens. Jesus said on the last night of his life, it's in the context of serving, laying down his life. He says, these things I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. That as we go out to serve and lay our lives down, Jesus says, I want to bring joy into your life. Why do I feel like I'm always just giving up and giving up all these things for Christ? It's that's your problem right there. You're thinking about, what am I giving up? You should be thinking about, what am I giving out to other people? And as you give out, all of a sudden you start to see the joy of Christ come into your life. John 13:17. If you know these things, and the context is washing the disciples' feet, it's servant love. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Not if you think about them, not if you talk about them, even if you pray about them. I mean, those are all good things to do. That's not the promise here. It's if you do them. Acts 20:35, Jesus himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. I know we see that word blessed and we're like, blessed, what's that mean? Makarios, it means to be fortunate, happy, privileged. Think about that. The key to a happy life, where you feel fortunate, that you just feel privileged to be in your own shoes. Or you wake up every day and you just feel like, thank you, God. Thank you, God, that I get to live this life. Thank you. That is a life of giving out love to other people. Jesus had this little riddle. Check this one out. Luke 9:24. He says, whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who saves it. This statement appears in all four Gospels at least once, and in two Gospels, it appears twice. This is Jesus' most repeated teaching, that if you're living a life for yourself, where you're trying to get more for me, he says that's the best way to lose your life. That's the best way to an unfulfilling life. But if you're living a life for others, and this isn't something we dabble in, this love, we're talking about something we are engaged in, we're committed to, that is the way that in this strange way, God, as you give out, he starts to give back in. And Jesus must have been talking about this all the time. Selfishness versus selflessness. Well, in our concluding time here, I thought I would just read to you from a book. I mentioned it, I think, a week or two ago. It's a little bit questionable. I can't quite endorse it. It isn't for the things she says in the book. It's for the things that she doesn't talk about. The book is titled The Upside of Stress, and she basically talks about how stress, everyone thinks stress is lethal, it's poisonous, and she's a social scientist out of Stanford University. She basically says it's not the stress, it's your attitude, it's your beliefs, your mindset toward the stress. I can't endorse it because she doesn't have a word to say about people who overschedule, who overdo. And frankly, that's a sin. Overworking is a sin. Overdoing is a sin. There's limits. And God even tells us to take breaks, to take rests, okay? That being said, this book is going to knock your socks off, okay? If I made all the, you shouldn't read it, okay, now we should read it. Check it out. Kelly McGonigal, she says, when we care for others, it changes our biochemistry, activating systems of the brain that produce feelings of hope and courage. Helping others also protects against the harmful effects of even chronic or traumatic stress. That instead of trying to keep yourself safe from all the stress and everything out there, when you actually face it, she's saying, and you love other people, this makes you resilient to stress. The social caregiving system is regulated by oxytocin. When this system is activated, you feel more empathy, you feel more connection and trust, as well as a stronger desire to bond or be close with others. This network also inhibits the fear centers of the brain, increasing your courage. How about that? A lot of the anxiety is because we're so afraid of stepping out. She's saying just the opposite. It's as you step out in love to face this, this increases your courage. The reward system releases the neurotransmitter dopamine. Activation of the reward system increases motivation while dampening fear. I wonder if much, I'm not going to be binary, this is the magic key here, but hear me out, much of our fear is through conflict avoidance, where I'm afraid and then I back away. And she's saying just the opposite here. It's as we face it. All of a sudden, that's when we get freedom. Dopamine helps you feel more optimistic about your ability to do something meaningful. It also primes the brain for physical action, making sure you don't freeze under pressure. The attunement system is driven by the neurotransmitter serotonin. When this system is activated, it enhances your perception, intuition, and self-control. Those would be all the different things you would expect to decrease in stress. She says, as we actually reach out to love, these become very sharpened. We become sharper. Attend and befriend response makes you social, brave, and smart. It provides both the courage and the hope we need to propel us into action and the awareness to act skillfully. Whether you are overwhelmed by your own stress or the suffering of others, think about that. I feel overwhelmed by these people's problems. The way to find hope is to connect, not to escape. That when I'm right at that moment where I might be feeling like, I can't take this today. I've had too much. I'm over the top. And for you to run, be a runner, that's only going to make it worse, is what she's saying. In any situation where you feel powerless, doing something to support others, love others, can help you sustain your motivation and optimism. Oh, she's got the goods here. Study after study after study after study. Here's one, a time scarcity study at U of Penn. People who say, oh, I don't have enough time for stuff. I can't get enough done at work. I just need more time, more time, more time. Okay? Group number one, they said, you just have extra free time. You do whatever you want with it. So you want more time? You got it. Group number two, they gave them extra free time, but they said, it's not really free. You got to go help one of your coworkers. What'd they find? Surprisingly, helping someone else decreased people's feeling of time scarcity more than actually giving them the extra time. Oh, I don't have time. I don't have time. And then all of a sudden I go out and I serve. Why is it that the people around you that are the biggest servants, the biggest lovers of people, are the ones that you would call when you have the flat tire? It's this right here. They reported afterward that they felt more capable, competent, and useful than people who had spent the time on themselves. This, in turn, changed how they felt about what they had to accomplish and their ability to handle the pressure. The altruism study out of the University of Oregon. Each person was given $100, okay? And then they said, you want to donate to the local food bank. The people who donated freely, they had the highest rate of brain changes in their mood. Okay, brain changes predicting their mood. They made some of them involuntarily donate. And that even helped a little bit too. So forcing people to give wasn't even that bad. The best group was the group that said, yeah, I'll give $20 to the food bank. And their happiness increased. So even our money, our time, what else could there be? Bigger than self goals. She says when people are connected to bigger than self goals, they feel better, more hopeful, curious, caring, grateful, inspired, and excited. It seems to be the degree to which you are connected with something ultimate, transcendent. May I add, real. Kelly McGonigal is not a Christian. She just thinks it's the life force of the universe. She keeps talking about the universe. I don't know how the universe gives you anything. Universe hasn't spoken to me lately about my life or its purpose. But something transcendent, which is real. Oh, all these different adjectives are used. In contrast, when people are operating from self-focused goals, they're more likely to feel confused, anxious, angry, envious, and lonely. She says it's better if the people actually choose their own goals. I have to agree with that. When people give me the goals I'm supposed to care about, I don't seem to really care that much about it. What about the Detroit study? 846 people. Caring created resilience among those who did not routinely help others. Every significant stressful life event increased the risk of dying by 30%. But participants who went out of their way to help others showed absolutely no stress-related increased risk of death. In fact, when they had experienced several traumatic events, they had the same risk of dying as people who experienced no major stressful life events. This is her thesis. It isn't the stressor. It isn't the thing that you're scared of. It's your view of it. That's her view. They seem to be completely protected from the harmful effects of stress. She goes on, after the death of a spouse, taking care of others reduces depression. Survivors of a natural disaster are less likely to develop PTSD if they help others in the immediate aftermath. Wouldn't that be the thing that a person would say, that's the last thing you'd ever want to do, is go back to that place that caused you the trauma, but the people who went back there to help and to love lowered the PTSD. Helping others doesn't just transform the psychological impact of suffering, it also protects us against the harmful effects of severe life stress on physical health. In fact, she writes, helping others seems to eliminate the impact of traumatic events on health and longevity. This is what Dr. Ralph Ankenman used to refer to as love therapy. That most of the problems in our life could be resolved if we just learned how to love other people. Getting the focus off of my thoughts and my problems and my insecurities and how I look and how I feel, and start to get that spotlight turned around onto other people. And all of a sudden, a lot of these issues, most of the problems in our life, are cured by learning how to love. Well, finally, how do we love? And we'll close on this. I got three suggestions here. For one, write out for about 10 minutes your convictions and your values. When you think about where I'm headed in life, what is it that I believe? What is it that I want? Ask yourself the question, you know, what do I believe is most important in life? McGonigal says, writing this out for 10 minutes can have effects up to 10 to 12 months later. So just saying, what is my goal? What do I believe is true? All of a sudden these stressors come in and you're like, of course I'm experiencing obstacles, but I've got values here. I got something I'm living for. Have I written down goals in my relationship with God and with others? If you don't make a goal, you'll achieve it every time. It's only people who make goals that they try, and then they're like, well, I might fail. That's why we have grace. No problem with that. But not even trying. See, I just don't agree with that. Asking yourself the question, am I committed before God in prayer to persevere based on what I believe, based on what I value? No matter what the obstacles. If you have these convictions up front, by the time those obstacles face you, you're going to be prepared. To be based on conviction, all of a sudden, you're going to be ready for it. Number two, look to meet the needs that are around you. You know, asking yourself the question, what are the names of the people who need help? Not just this nebulous, very abstract, oh yeah, I should kind of help people. Give me the names of the people that you can say, that person needs help. If you're a person who says, well, I just don't see the needs around me, then I would suggest that you open up your eyes a little bit, because there's an ocean of needs, and that must mean you're just not looking. That's what that means. What are ways that I might be uniquely suited to help them, a way that maybe somebody else couldn't? Have I prayed about a plan to help them? Something to consider. Number three, assess current relationships. This is important too. It's not just loving a bunch of acquaintances, but friends. Am I getting dedicated, regular time with key people in my life? Are there people that I'm just like, I'm not going to cancel. We're going to meet. Do I show up ready to share and to listen? Yeah, I've got something to give out and I want to listen in. There's a form of Christianity that people are constantly asking questions. You got to be able to do both, to be vulnerable and to accept vulnerability. Maybe asking yourself the question as we studied these, you know, sacrifice, emotion, forgiveness, confrontation. In which one of these am I most efficient? In praying that God would utilize this whole project, that he would change you into an area where you would be like him, that you would learn how to love. And if we pray about this, this is a prayer that God always answers, that he will change you into being like himself.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.